Formula Access. This week we bring you Nick Mosley of Alpine F1. I've worked really hard to string the process of aerodynamics together for you guys, and today we have a model maker. You guys, this is the role that builds the scaled parts for the wind tunnel. I've worked really, really hard to hunt this role down. This is a role that has been requested by you all quite a bit, and I've reached out to all of them. And Nick was so kind to come on the show. Alpine was so great to kind of get us through the approval process to get him on the show. You guys, sit down, relax, and enjoy an awesome episode. Formula Access. I have been searching for a string of titles for quite some time now, and this is the last piece of the puzzle. We had Catherine Richards as a wind tunnel tech. She deflected a lot of questions to aerodynamicists and model makers, and so I could get no context for you guys on what those roles actually were, what their contribution to that process was. I got an aerodynamicist on the show. We now have a model maker. Everyone is kind of clamoring for this, which I find fascinating. And so finally today, we have Nick Mosley of Alpine coming on the show. Nick, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It seems so crazy to like that's this thing, but I've joked about it in episodes, and then all of a sudden I get these private messages, among others, is like, get people from America on the show at Formula One teams, which is virtually impossible. And then a model maker, like, we want to finish this thing. I'm LinkedIn messaging all these people. I'm like, get on the show. And they're like, I have a totally uninteresting job. And I'm like, no, you do. Take my word for it. So seriously, thank you.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
So just to level set the audience, the people that haven't listened to the previous shows and this kind of string of communication, what do you do today?
So my name is Nick Mosley. I am a model maker at Alpine F1 team. The role is very generic across most of the F1 team. They just have slight variations how they will run it. But generally, the wind tunnel model is a scaled, 60% scaled version of the full-size race car. So everything you see on the race car will be on the wind tunnel model. The model maker's job is to prepare the parts and to also work in the wind tunnel. And that's fundamentally what your role is. It's spread over various different shifts. So if certain teams want to run 7 days a week, depending on how many runs they have in the wind tunnel. So it's each team will have their own way of doing it, but generally they'll all adhere to the same rules.
And it's a scaled part. So your like objective in this role or this process is to create the shape, right? To understand the vortices or the way the wind moves through that part. Is that?
So that would probably be more coming from the aero side of things. So they will design their or draw their part, and then that will go off to surfacing, who will then create that part to which can then be built from that file that they produce. Once that part is produced, it is then over to the model makers then to make sure that part is what the aeros are looking for. So the shape will be the same. There'll be no like broken parts, anything like that. So everything is what they expect to see. So they can put that on the wind tunnel model and they can test that part to see whether it's a gain in inside the wind tunnel.
I find this thing so fascinating. I like what everyone does in a team first off is fascinating, because it's like, you're not just building the shell of a car and a tire, like a road car. You're building this thing. I can't remember. It might've been Helmut who said like the ideal, or maybe it was Adrian who said like the best built F1 car should like disintegrate or evaporate when it crosses the finish line. Like it should be that efficient. Like stuff just stops working when it's no longer needed and it falls off the car. It just like, I don't know. Sometime I wish a team would invite me to the factory and just let me like watch this whole process take place and everything. I love it. I'm fascinated by it. And I'm just kind of an innovation geek. I love to watch how people put that stuff together. So how, like, how is that role important? So like, can't you just, where does the expertise come in the, like, building the part itself?
The part will come from a printing machine, and that will then need to go through various different stages of painting and everything else like that. So you have to make sure that the quality of that part has to be, you know, 100%. You can't have a part that's 90% sort of prepared. It's just not going to be what they expect to see. Obviously, they run these parts through the CFD program that they have, as all F1 teams do. So they've got a general idea of what sort of trend they want to follow. So if a part isn't as the quality that it's needed, it's going to be, the result they're going to see, it could be okay, but it could not be okay. So they want to try and eliminate all the, any sort of thing that could affect the result, basically what they want to see. I mean, they design parts, they want to see all the parts they design to be a performance gain. So if you could have two parts the same, and if one isn't prepared the same, then it might give slightly different results. So the quality has to be 110% every time. You can't really cut corners because you're talking such fine margins. And certainly with how close it is within F1 these days, it's fine margins that sort of put you from the middle of the pack to the back, or from the front to the back. So it's the consistency is key, but the level of detail has to be there for everything. And it goes from planning to preparing the parts. So it's one of those roles that you really do need to take your time, even though you don't have as much time as you always would like to have, but you have to be consistent and try and make sure that everything is 100% really.
Do you have to have like a level of OCD to be able to do that? It sounds to me like the perfection is important.
It is. It definitely is. OCD has definitely got to be a part of it, because you want to make sure that it's the best it possibly can be. And it comes down to sort of who you are as well. So if you're that sort of person that wants to cut corners, then yeah, you could cut corners, but it's not going to be what you want to see. So the OCD, I mean, everyone that I sort of work with, they all do the same job, and they all prepare the part the same way. So they must have that level of OCD. to want to do it as well, because it can be the same thing quite a lot, sort of every day, and it can be, sometimes it can be, oh, the same parts will come through again, I've got to do another one, but you still have to have that care and attention to making sure that everyone is as good as the last one. So it definitely does come down to a high level of attention, I'll say, rather than OCD.
I wish people would view these things. Actually, so I started this whole thing with the blog on kind of the business and the leadership and just culture of Formula One. Why I started writing about this, like, I'm not in Formula One, so like, I really don't know. I'm just saying, like, if I was this thing, this is how I would handle it as an entrepreneur, or a business owner, or a leader, or whatever that is. And it's funny to me on social media when I see people look at like OCD or ADD as like this negative thing. I was like, I am all those things, and it makes me really effective. And I would imagine those would be qualities in Formula One that would work really well. Like, if you saw my desk, like, my mouse and my pens and my paper are like completely symmetrical. And like, I can just feel when something's not right or perfect. I could imagine that role would probably feel a lot like that. Like, it
definitely would. Yeah, you definitely fit in.
The paint's not right. There's a bubble in the paint.
Yeah, throw exactly it in the trash can. Mm-hmm.
All while doing it at 100 miles an hour under a tight deadline, and then getting it to the track yesterday.
Yep. that's F1 all over. That is, yeah. Everything's got to be done yesterday, but to be the best standard that you've ever done. So yeah, that's definitely how it works.
So people ask me, like, as a business owner, like, what's it like? And I was like, okay, so imagine you're at the top of Mount Everest and you have like a bag full of parts, and then you jump off the top of it. You have to build an airplane and fly it before it hits the ground. And that's kind of what it's like. And Formula One feels so much like it. Maybe that's why I'm such a fan of it, is just because it feels like my life all the time. No margin for error, quick decisions, perfection, which doesn't exist, but you got to try.
Yeah, you strive for that, don't you?
Like, so in that role, what would you say is like the most challenging aspect of that? Not technically, but like when you're building these parts, like what can be frustrating or challenging, or like
probably the deadlines could be quite challenging sometimes, especially like you could have a front wing that needs to be built from scratch. So it's a time consuming job, because you have to set so many different parameters to make sure it's where everything is, needs to be from the drawing that you're given. So the probably the biggest sort of factor is the deadline, because they obviously, especially when like this time of year now, it's getting really busy. So we got testing coming up, and then there's a quick reaction where you want to try different things because the car's not run on track properly yet. So you look at all the data they gather from the track, and then there's a quick reaction. Then they want to, I don't know, they've seen a trend at the track that they could follow. So they want to turn things around really quickly. And I think for the deadline is probably the biggest, one of the biggest, I say not limitations, but I'd say it's one of the biggest factors in how you go about your job. So you get your job for the day, and then you need to try and get as much of that done by the end of the day, basically. So it can be quite challenging in that sense.
I just to like level set that, I had to think about that for a second, but like I always imagine things in my head, and yeah, the speed at the factory at which you guys work is phenomenal, but then you have to like account for, well, if we're in France, you guys are in France, right?
The UK. So the
UK, factory, okay,
is F1. Yeah, F1 is.
Okay. So you have to get it from the UK to the track.
Yeah.
And like lightning speed. And, you know, this is not kind of a trucked thing. This is like a logistical, honestly, like this is also a massively proprietary piece of stuff. So like if the box breaks, like what sort of access does somebody have to like your R&D? Like it just, to me, that stuff becomes so fascinating, because that IP is so, so valuable, and, you know, it can be game changing. Like,
definitely.
You know, Braun could barely afford to get to the track in 2007, and yeah, one part was the difference maker in them pulling that championship together.
Absolutely.
So your experience has been like, it's actually fascinating. So you've worked for a number of teams, but your roles have been all over the place. Like you've not been a entry-level model maker, a senior model maker, a manager of model maker, like you've been in a lot of roles. What is the evolution of that?
Basically it was, obviously I came from the track side, working for various different formulas over the years. And obviously as a kid growing up and watching F1, you know, I knew about wind tunnel testing. I didn't really know how they went about it. And it was, I think it was in 2016 that I had applied for a job with Williams, and it was a wind tunnel test technician. So I read the job specification, so I sort of understood how it worked, what they were looking for. So I had my interview, and when I had the interview, it surprised me a little bit that they were actually looking for people that were coming from the pit lane, if you'd like. So they're working under pressure, and they understood sort of timelines and deadlines and everything else like that. So It sort of surprised me that's what they would look for, because I would have thought like you need to be, you know, degree level sort of educated, you need to really know all about aerodynamics and things like that. But it was, a lot of it is like that, but it's not the fundamental part of the role. So it's quite funny that I found that when I got into the role, there was quite a few people that I knew from the track that were actually doing that role, but we'd never really spoken about it, so we didn't know how we got to apply for these jobs. And they were looking for that sort of person, and that's how I got into it, really. So it was, I would say it's not by accident. It was this, it surprised me that they were looking for that. So once I found out they were looking for that, I thought I knew I had those traits. So working under pressure, and the pressure is a different kind of pressure. It's obviously when you're at the racetrack, there's more of a deadline, because the car has to go on track unless there's like something's really, really wrong. But the car will always be on track. Whereas if something doesn't quite work on the wind tunnel model, you have a little bit of leeway. Obviously, you have to make that time back up, but you've got more scope to do that. So the pressures are very different, but they're still equally there.
Okay, I'm going to pause you. For all of our wonderful Drive to Survive fans, what does a race technician do? I've nailed like four titles with this interview here. So,
so the race technician has various different roles. You get your number one mechanics, who basically are in charge of that car. So they'll be looking after the basically everything that happens on that car. So they'll primarily look at the gearbox and the rear suspension, things like that. You get number two mechanics then, who generally have, it depends how big the team is. Like with F1 teams, you'd have more than one. But in the lower formulas, you generally have just two guys, race technicians, working on the car. So like the number two mechanic will be in charge of looking after the front end, making sure all suspension is all built up, everything sort of working in that area. And then you almost meet in the middle, whereas where the driver sits, so you sort of do your jobs and you sort of meet in the middle once the driver's ready to get into the car. So the race technician is hands-on the race car at the race weekend and at the workshop. So when car builds go on, the race technicians are generally involved with that kind of stuff as well.
And then you went to the wind tunnel. Isn't the track more exciting?
It definitely is. It really is. It's like some of the experiences you get just being in the pit lane, you realize just how fast the cars are and how fast things actually happen around you. And you have to be really switched on with what's going on, because you know, if you need to cross over the pit lane, there's a speed limit now, but that speed limit is still pretty fast when you're stood by the car traveling past you. Is it 100 kilometers an hour? I think it is. That's still quite fast when you're stood next to the track. So it's definitely is an exciting role. But for me, when I sort of wanted to move into the wind tunnel, I made the decision that I wanted to be sort of home a bit more and be around my family and things like that. So I took the decision then to sort of look for something that was factory based. And it's obviously with the F1 calendar is just getting bigger and bigger, and it's a lot of traveling. So to be away that much and miss so much of the kids sort of doing the general like school life and just growing up, I wanted to be a bit more involved with that. So I don't think I could have committed to doing 23 races a year. That's I don't think the my missus would be too happy with me doing that. So
No, I have this stupid 20 year from now dream to work in Formula One. Mm-hmm. And you know, and a joke when people ask me about it, you know, they're like, when are you going to do this? Like you've got this show. I'm like, yeah, this show does not get me on a team, but I said, my kids have to be like totally self-sufficient and on their own. I just like, I'm not going to miss any of this. So I applaud you for having the wherewithal to make the decision, you know, not just for yourself, but for your family, and say like, hey, I want to be around the kids, because you don't get that stuff back. And I could tell you, as I got a 16-year-old, I feel like, you know, he was born like yesterday. It goes by really quick. And then, you know, now that he goes out with his friends, we just sit on the couch and we're like, what do we do? I don't have to cook. I don't have to clean for anybody. I don't have to entertain anyone. And he's gone. Like, what is this? Yeah. What's been your favorite role? Like, family aside, this is not to offend family members or teammates, but just like, what's been the funnest?
I'd probably say when I was working with Caterham were within F1, but they had it's F2 now, but it was GP2 back then. And it was I worked with some great people, sort of friends that I knew a couple of the guys before that. So it was working with them was probably one of the best years, purely because it was basically the next step was F1, and the cars were they weren't the hybrid at that point. So it was V8s revving to 10,000 RPM, things like that, and they were so noisy. And it's what I love about motorsport is there's just the engines and things like that. So to work on those cars, I think that was probably the most fun. And some of the opportunities that presented as well with various days out with sponsors and things like that, that was good fun. That was definitely one of my highlight reels. And with the drivers that I worked with that year as well, there was two world-class drivers. So again, that's always something to be to look back at. That, yeah, I've worked with some race winners or Indy 500 winners. So yeah, I can always say that.
Yeah, you sent me those names. Like, how did you end up with those two?
So Alexander Rossi was at Caterham while he was sort of trying to make his step into F1. And they sort of, it was almost like the junior team for the F1 team. So the next stepping stone for the both drivers was to try and get into the full seats within F1. So obviously with Caterham, it was... they probably didn't have the budget like the other teams did. So the year that I was there was sort of their final year on the grid. So there was lots of different things going about. So once Caterham were pulling out of F1, obviously there was no seats left for the driver potentially to fight for. So Alexander Rossi made the decision to leave Caterham. I don't know the ins and outs, whether there was contract issues or anything else like that. But all I know is that he decided to not to drive for that team. And as the next driver that came in was Pierre Gasly, and that was his first races under GP2. So yeah, that within GP2. So yeah, that's how it all came about, really. So I don't know how the deal got done or anything like that. But I just remember that we were told that we had a Red Bull driver coming in, and yeah, it turned out to be Pierre Gasly.
And now you have full circle. He's back.
Exactly. This is it. Yeah, exactly. I haven't seen him around the workshop yet, but he has been a few times. Whether you recognize him or not now, I doubt it very much. But I can still say that I worked with you at Caterham, so I could almost jog his memory, maybe.
So I'm a big adversity guy. Like I like somebody that's had to fight, you know, and they've had to deal with insurmountable pressure or insurmountable adversity. And I just, again, we go back to the whole like OCD ADD thing. Like people look at his time with Gasly's time with Red Bull as like this big black mark on it. I'm like, yeah, no, like this is his taste of big time. Like this is how you learn how to win championships is like, what does pressure feel like at that level? And, you know, while I quite frankly don't agree with the way that it was handled, he got a taste of that. And I think if you look at him back, he's a way better driver now.
Definitely. He definitely is. Yeah. I mean, he's always been fast and he's always been a good driver. Yeah. So you don't lose that overnight, and he's still a fast driver to this day. So, you know, you have these setbacks. I mean, everyone goes through setbacks in whatever career you do, don't you? So the setback he had was, yeah, however it was dealt with, it was almost a building point for him, because he came back after that to win a Grand Prix. He outperformed what he was working with. So it showed his sort of his character, if you like, that he was able to bounce back from it.
He came back with a backbone too. I think
pressure
is one thing, but he came back with this like this degree of backbone where he would like, he would talk to the media, he would talk to the teams, and he was like really honest, and he really like, he wasn't tiptoeing or hem-hawing with anybody or like giving them the corporate robot speech. It was like, yeah, I don't agree with that, you know, or like, hey, look at me now. And, and I think this opportunity for him to come to Alpine is just phenomenal. I think the rise of the team has just been consistently up, and you know, you've had some really talented people in the team to kind of help usher that on the way up. And Rossi's one of them too. Like Rossi's story is on, what is the F1 branded podcast? Like Above the Line or something like that. Mm-hmm. He went on there and he told his story, you know, coming through Formula One, and it's a really compelling story. And he's got a really cool relationship with his dad. I know one of his sponsors, and he's got a really cool. I got to get him on the show.
Yeah, definitely.
I got to pull some of those strings. Maybe you could help.
I'm not sure about that.
Hey, we haven't talked for 10 years. You want to know this guy? Nobody really knows him. So, okay, so you worked with some big drivers. You've worked all over the paddock. Like, what's your origin story? How did this all begin?
Basically, ever since I was a child, I've grown up with motorsport. I think back sometimes, I probably don't know much more than motorsport, really. It's sort of been in my family. From my father being into his rallying, building his own car to go rallying with his brother. So I ever since I was a child, I've always been around rally cars, hearing rally cars, because my father owns his own garage. So he worked on these cars. He had customers who had their cars. So I can always remember being around rallying. So I can remember as a child going to watch these rallies, listening to the engines and just watching cars going sideways. So that's basically where it's all stemmed from. The motorsport bug has been there before I even realized it, to be honest.
Every guest, male, female, American, for like watching races with dad. I can appreciate that so much. I mean, I had to become a fan all on my own, but my kids definitely, you know, will sit. My daughter will hang out with me just because she wants to hang out. She has no idea what's going on, nor does she care. But my son definitely like loves karting and racing, and he'll hang out just by necessity. Yeah. That'll change. I'm gonna go to Miami with him this year. So
that'd be good.
I think that'll be the turning point of his interest in Sunday morning Formula One. So you're around motorsports all of your childhood. Yeah. You got your dad's garage. Is this like a lifelong ambition to be in F1 or be in motorsports? Or
yes, so I always want to be a racing driver along those lines as growing up. Obviously, to be a racing driver, it takes financial commitment to do that. So it's not something you'll take on sort of half-heartedly. You have to sort of put everything on the line almost if you don't have that sort of that background where you have like sponsors or anything like that. So if you're just doing it from paying your mum and dad's money, it's a little bit different then. So obviously they've got to pay the bills and everything else like that. So always wanted to go karting as a child, and I did it briefly, but it was never an option to fully go racing with that, obviously with the cost of everything. So once I'd sort of gotten older and realized what sort of path I wanted to go down, it was definitely sort of F1 is what, I mean, a lot of people say it's the pinnacle of motorsport, isn't it, with all the advancements or what you see with technology and things like that. So ultimately, that was probably the end goal. I had no idea how I was going to get to do that. I just sort of played along with it for a little bit until I sort of made the commitment that I really want to try and push and get there and just do what I've got to do to get there.
So you didn't go to school. This is just your experience working in a garage basically your entire childhood.
So I did school. I did all my I know it's slightly different for you guys, you have high school, things like that. So I did all my high school, right, and I did my the exams you have to do for your qualifications to move on to your college or university. So once I'd left school at about 18, I sort of worked in my father's garage full-time from then, and that's sort of helped shape where my experience came from. I mean, you work on so many different cars on the road, and you pick up so many different skills, and the experience that my father and my uncle also sort of taught me, it sort of broadens your horizon to just your general, you know, you just take your wheel off, put your wheel on, things like that. So I had the experience coming from that sort of stemmed, put me in good stead for what I wanted to do later on. But it was only when My father was looking to sort of sell up and sort of not retire. He wanted to move on with doing different things within the industry. It sort of pushed me to then look to what I wanted to do. So that's when I went to university. I studied a motorsport engineering course. I did that for 2 years. And I look back at that time and I think, what did I really learn from that I didn't already know? Because it was very much, you didn't really learn a lot of hands-on stuff, but I sort of knew what I wanted to do. So the main thing I should say, it really did open the door into the industry for me, because without that course, there's no way I would have made the contacts that I had to then pursue a career in motorsport.
It's funny that you mentioned that. So I'm a sales guy by nature, an entrepreneur. School wasn't for me, mm-hmm. at least as a child. When I was an adult and I got competitive and they OCD, whatever. I'd get upset when I had a 99, but I find it interesting just you can't have a degree. So here in America, I don't know if you guys have this, but we can test out of classes. So in college, I tested out of all business, marketing, and leadership class. I never had to take the class. I basically just went into a testing center and took the final. And if you pass it, you pass the class. If not, then obviously you have to take the class. But do they have that over there?
I don't think so, no. I mean, you can go back and do sort of the test that you haven't passed, but you have sort of studied that subject. But not that I'm aware of. I don't think we have that here.
Oh, that's awesome. did you do Formula Student at all?
No, so I didn't do any of that. It was, to be quite honest, it was full when I went to look at the enrollment. So there would be very little sort of hands-on experience you could have gained from, because it was so competitive, never wanted to do it. I sort of based the experience that I had before, that I almost knew how to work on the cars themselves. So I thought, yes, it'd been good to have on my CV, but I didn't necessarily need to have that with the experience that I had before. So it's, it definitely was. It was available, but when I went, I do remember going to look at it, sign on. It was definitely full with reserves and a few extra.
Yeah, we only have two schools here in the U.S. that do that.
And, really?
I can't imagine. I can't imagine with the popularity of the sport over there, how difficult that would be of a program to get into, and how competitive it would be. The challenge, how do you get these kids to deal with that? So, okay, so in your career, you have a pretty cool CV. You've been GP2, you've been F1. I mean, you've worked for a number of teams and big name teams and big name drivers. What's been the hardest part, or a moment of adversity in your career?
I think the biggest thing is not knowing how to get to where the end goal is and how you get there. I can remember once I was at Singapore working on a Formula BMW Asia Championship, and we were outside. We were a support race for the F1, and looking into those garages and then seeing all the guys working on the F1 cars. And I remember thinking, how do you get to that? How do you do that? And I was only doing a small lower formula, and then to the top of the tree it's almost daunting, if you like, how you get to that point, and then just thinking to myself, how do I do that? And having to think, is that possible? And then if it is possible, what do I do next? And it's just, I think that's probably the biggest challenge that anyone faces within the industry. If you want to get to F1, is how you get to F1. It's such a competitive industry, and when you think about it, there's only, say, 10 teams at the moment. So the amount of roles that are available, they don't come about very often. And if you've got one role with 100 people going for it, it then becomes a very competitive market. So I think that probably not knowing how to get to the end goal is sometimes it can be a bit of a challenge.
Okay, how did you overcome that? So you went from a junior category. How did you get to the big show?
So it's I think the biggest thing for me was that along the way I made some good contacts, and it's not necessarily contact because you get on with someone. I tried to make sure that if people remembered me because I'd done a good job, and they would recommend you because they've seen what you can do, not because you're a friend or something like that. So I think for me, just getting my head down and working hard. And you know, when you work for the lower formula teams, you don't always have a lot to do at the workshop. So it's almost creating jobs that might not be even associated with the cars or anything to do with that. It's just improving different things, or it could just be painting the workshop floors. You know, you just get stuck in. And once you have that sort of people see you doing that, they realize there's a bit more about you, that you're not just there for the almost like the glory of just working on the race car. So there's a lot more to certainly the lower formulas than just working on the cars. So I think the contacts that I made along the way, without a doubt, have helped me get to where I've got to today.
Yeah, a lot of people just in my content and in general always ask, you know, how did they get this role? How did they get it? Obviously, like, listen to the show and you'll hear the stories. But I think there's always a lot of assumptions to, like, what is expected. And there's been several guests that I've had that have kind of had really impactful comments. Like, I had Dan Jones from Mercedes HPP on, you know, and I was asking him, because he does a lot of recruiting. And I said, you know, what are you looking for? You know, it's a meritocracy, you know, and so you have a pool of people. Like, how do you determine that? And, you know, I expected him to say, we take the top two of every class, you know, and that's who we hunt. And it wasn't. It was, well, we look at their, you know, yes, are they talented engineers, but are they also creative? You know, can they work through the gray areas of the rules and find creative ways to play within the rules as well as innovate and do it fast? And I just always thought that was impactful for young people to hear that, you know, yeah, you might not have 110% in your class, but if you're really creative, you could beat those guys out or those gals out to that role.
As I was going to school, but more so when I was at university and doing the engineering course, so as a student, I was never very good in the classroom. I got by, but it was harder to do it that way, to read from a textbook, than it was to actually have something in front of me I could take apart and put together. I could learn so much more from doing that. And it's not always about how much you know about something from a textbook. It's about understanding how fundamentally something works. And I think if you can understand it, even if you understand from a textbook, it doesn't matter. As long as you understand how it works, I think that's what they're looking for, more so than you might have scored 100% in every test. But when you see something in front of you, you don't know what sort of size spanner to use to take it apart or things like that, you know. So it's definitely... I think they definitely do look for, I think if they could get someone who could do all of that, then they're pretty lucky, because I think a lot of people will sort of specialize in certain ways of doing something or understanding how it works. I mean, everyone's different, aren't they? So it's what works for that person individually, really.
So you also have a really unique, and I just wanted to throw this in there because this actually hit my feed this morning, and I had somebody ask me the question of, how do you become a race mechanic? Like, are you an engineer by trade, or are you, like, how do these people get jobs?
So I think you can go through, we have, like, your college, I think, is slightly different to our college. So when you're 16, you can leave school and you can go to do a college and you can do an apprenticeship it's along those lines. So you can do an apprenticeship within motorsport where you basically, you're hands-on from the very start. So you still start off with helping the garage technicians or the truckies, what we call them. So they just sort of look after all the wheels, the tires, and all the parts on the truck and everything else like that. So they generally have a helper. So like when you come out of college or you do your one day at a work placement, depends how it works, you generally help the guys around the just getting used to the environment. And then you progress from there. Then in the lower formulas, you start, you eventually get in charge of a car. So you learn how to work on that car and then you move up the formulas as you go. So obviously it depends what you're looking for. I mean, some people can go from working on a car to be a team manager, or you can go from working on a car to working in F1. There's very different sort of ways to get there. But fundamentally, if you want to start from the bottom, you work your way up and then you sort of gain the experience of how it all works. And the biggest thing is understanding how like a race weekend would work, because it's not your conventional hours. It's not your 9 to 5 sort of job. It could be early starts, late finishes with very little sleep in between, depending on how your day's gone or what time you start the next day. So I think that's one of the biggest shocks to the system, is that you could work so many hours in one day, more than that's available. But it's definitely getting used to the environment that you're working in, and then the pressure as well. The pressure is very different to, again, your sort of standard 9 to 5 job. So it's not easy, but it's not impossible. But I can say that now because I'm sat here and I've been there and I've got the t-shirt. So,
but that's what authorizes you to teach it, is because you've walked that walk. It wasn't, I just got this role because my dad is the team owner, or the guy that runs the mechanics team. It's you ground it out is probably the best word, maybe, mm-hmm. and did it yourself. And so now you can teach it and talk about it, and just provide a level of hope to other people. But everyone has passion, right? Like the number one thing on a resume is like, you work those hours because it's kind of like the most important thing to you, yeah. Like not a paycheck. It's
that's it. Yeah, you wouldn't work all these hours if you didn't care about something, what you're doing. Like the passion is always there. You speak to most of the guys that I've worked with over the years, and you ask them what got them into it and stuff. Well, they watched it with their dad, their uncle, their brothers, and things like that. But a lot of the time as well, underlying is that they wanted to be a racer themselves, and that's the passion where it comes from. And it's definitely there. And that competitive sort of streak is in everyone in the industry, because everyone's there because they want to be there. And it doesn't matter how long you've been in it for, at some point you've got that passion to want to do it. So.
Okay. So what's been your biggest learning experience in your career? Like, what did you ever have an aha moment in your career where it like redefined your passion or your story, or just it totally changed the game of what you did?
So I think one of the biggest sort of, I don't even like talking about it, but it's, I was obviously with GP2, you do live pit stops. And when I did my second or third race I did with the team, two laps from the end, the wheel that I was working on came off the car. And it was like, I didn't understand what had happened, because I thought I've done nothing different to what I've done in the two previous races or however many practice sessions that I'd had. And it was a big shock to the system and whatever. It made me reevaluate what I should be doing. And I think it was probably, I should have said something a bit sooner, because I sort of realized something probably wasn't quite right with my wheel gum in the practice in the morning. But on the, as you look at this, there was nothing wrong with it, and you pressed the trigger and everything sounded the same. But it was only when you went to torque the actual nut, it sounded different. And I should have probably said something from that. So what I learned from that is that I needed to go back and practice and make sure that nothing like that ever happened again. But is to speak up when you need to speak up. And it's, I wish I had that sort of confidence to go and say, look, I don't think this is right. So it reignited sort of my passion, to make sure that, you do things to the best you can do. So it was definitely a wake up call. And it was also definitely a moment that was, it sort of changed my outlook and how I approached everything from that moment, really, because I didn't ever want something like that to happen again. And it was just it was one of those weekends I'd rather forget, but it's I think it taught me so much as well.
Well, I mean, okay, back in that situation, because I see it two ways, okay? Like, you could look at it and be like, yeah, that was my bad. But if you flip that around slightly and, like, it sounded strange or felt strange, but the car still drove off and it didn't fall off in the pit or on the first lap, like, and you created an event that caused the driver to have to pit again right away, which is obviously is a problem. And there was nothing wrong with it. Like, it could be just as bad. So, like, obviously not the danger aspect of it, but, like, do you ever run through that in your head? Like, you have to do that at 100 miles an hour and say, did that really sound bad?
Yeah, or it's one of those, isn't it? You know, I think the lack of experience I had with it was like, was it okay or was it not? And then obviously it had been, I don't know, 10, 15 laps, something like that. So yeah, it must be okay. And oh no, it's not okay. It's a bit different. Yeah. So it's like, oh no, it wasn't right. I should have said something. But yeah, I mean, hindsight is a wonderful thing. And when you look back at things, certainly look back at that moment. And yeah, I think, yeah, if I'd said something, would I have had the same outlook or would that changed how I sort of approached sort of every day after that with when it came to like to the workshop environment or to the weekends where you're racing. So I mean it almost made it almost like I'd work even harder to make sure nothing went wrong again like that. So yeah, it's I think it was it's definitely a wake-up call and an eye-opener, that's for sure.
That's okay. This is logged down as my favorite answer to that question. Because that's an impossible situation. It's not like, I don't know. It just like, it's an impossible decision that has to be made really fast.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, it could go either way in any scenario and you know, you got to live with it and stick with it. And it has stuck with you.
It definitely has.
That's a great story. Tell all your interns that story. Like,
yeah,
this is going to happen to you. Like, did your part fail on the track? And was it my fault or was it somebody else's? What in motorsports, what's been your pinch me moment? What's happened in your time in the sport where you're just like, holy crap, I can't believe I'm here.
I think when I first, moved into my job at Williams. As a child growing up, Williams were the team that were sort of winning races, winning championships with all the big name drivers. So they were always my favourite team growing up. So once I got my job at Williams, I thought that was my pinch me moment. I'm working for the team that was my sort of where my childhood spent watching the Grand Prix in the weekend was, but I think the real pinching moment was when I'd finished my shift in the wind tunnel and I was going to the gym. And as I walked through reception, it was Frank Williams was just there. And obviously he's an icon of the sport with everything that he's done. And you watch the stories and the films of him and just how passionate he was. But the real moment where I thought it was almost like being starstruck when I first saw him. And I didn't know, should I say hello? Should I stop and chat to him? What do I do? But he made it really easy for me because he actually stopped me and asked me who was. I haven't seen you here before. He realized that I wasn't sort of a regular member of the team. He'd obviously probably been told that who'd started at various points. So he knew that I wasn't a regular person, but he actually wanted to know who I was, where I'd come from. And I just remember sort of sat there with him just having a general chat with him, just and I was at that moment I realized like, wow, this is Frank Williams and this is what I've watched as a child growing up. But he made it really easy and he was really approachable, to be fair to him. He was he's definitely one of the icons of the F1 industry.
Yeah, I had his chief of staff on early on in the show and the consensus very much was the same. Like, he's just a a good human, and that bled into Claire, and she is a good human, with very approachable, very smart, and you know, passionate about the sport, and so on. I at some point, I've been talking to Claire about getting her on the show, mm-hmm. and just having a conversation, because obviously we can't have Frank on, but like, yeah. just you know, getting that story out and just like letting her, you know, tell it to America, I guess. Like, America's like half of my audience now. Like, I've got a ton from the UK as well. So I can't really call myself the American podcast. and India is making a quick run at the top too. It's pretty cool to see that. I was actually talking to, like, it's really strange, because like, I do this for fun, and like, I honestly, like, I have more fun just talking to all of you, and like, I get to record it and like distribute that. But I was talking to somebody at Chase about something with my company, and the guy was like looking at my name, and he's like, "You a Formula One fan?" And I was like, "Yeah, why?" And he's like, "Are you that guy from that podcast that had like this Red Bull Aero guy on?" And I was like, "Yeah, that was me." I was like, he's like, "Oh my God, I love this show." And I was like, "Really?" Like, and then I had another tech company as a vendor of my company. I was having a chat with from India, and you know, they've got this like AI tool that I use. And he was like, he kept pausing and like looking, and same thing. Like, "Do you do a podcast on Formula One?" Oh, yeah, all of our friends, like, we all listen to this. It's like, wow, that's so weird, but cool, like, at the same time. What didn't you expect when you got into motorsports? Like, what has shocked you or been surprising?
I think just how fast it really does move. And it's more so within F1, but even the lower formulas, and they're always trying to sort of keep up with what F1 is doing to a degree. But certainly when you're in F1, like you, the car just evolves so quickly, and it's just even the process that you go through. You could do a job for, say, 6 months, and then you come back to it 6 months later, and it's changed. And you know, and it's constantly evolving. And once I first started working in the wind tunnel, certainly that you walk in. So we used to do a different shift when I first started. You have 4 days on, 4 days off. You come back in after 4 days off, and the car is completely different to what you left it at. So it's like, where does that come from? And it goes together completely different. You've got to sort of teach yourself how it all works again. But it's quite crazy just how fast it really does evolve. And even from the technology that the wind tunnels are using, like it's for the 6 or so years that I've been doing it in the wind tunnels, just how much that they have evolved. And it's just mind blowing. Just that they're always constantly striving to find that breakthrough, or that last tenth of a second to move them up the grid. It is just crazy.
It's the speed and the pressure. I you guys are all like fighter pilots to me. I mean, it doesn't matter where you're at in the team, like everybody rows that boat, and you know, there's no singular thing that wins a championship. It's like everyone is rowing at the same goal and objective. And like, it's really obvious when somebody's not rowing. And it's really neat. I love this sport. And I actually, in my company, I use a lot of these conversations, and just like, this is what high performance looks like. And you know, this is what being passionate about a story and an objective looks like, versus like, we're all here for a paycheck, or just to show up to make my mortgage payment. There's other places you can go for that, but mm-hmm. so I always wrap my show up with advice, and that's always, I think, a big preface of my show has always been to address and unlock the things that you talked about earlier. Was like, hey, I'm in a junior team. How do I get to the top? I don't know how. I don't have a roadmap. I don't have a formula. I don't have anything. And there's something cool about figuring that out, the process. Like, it hurts, it sucks, it's hard, but like when you figure it out, you're just like, wow, that was really cool. I'm glad it's over, but it was really cool. What advice would you have for a young person that's either like starting university or they're young watching races with their dad and they're like, this is something that I want to pursue? Like, what advice do you have for them?
I think the passion has to be there from the start. You have to want to do it, because it's not your sort of 9-to-5 job that you could just go out anywhere and get. You have to work hard. But I wouldn't, like a lot of people would say that you need to go to university, you need to do all this. You don't have to go down that route. So don't think that if you can't get to university, you're not doing the course that you want to do, that's the end of the road. There is different ways in to do different things within the industry. But I think that fundamentally you just need to work hard. It's easy to say, you just have to work hard to sort of knuckle down. And I think as you go along, I think like I mentioned earlier, when you make contacts, but make contact for the right reason, and make sure that you're someone that people will remember because you've done a good job, or your attitude towards doing that job. It's not all jobs are glamorous within the industry, and you just have to just get on with it when it's there. I think that, yes, if you can go to university, yes, it's a great start, because if you want to do engineering, it's probably the best way to go about it. But nothing's out of reach if you want it enough. I definitely think that if you have that passion to want to do it, you will make whatever you need to do, you will get there. But I think that, like I say, the biggest thing is probably make good contacts with people who will, you can put down on your CV for future jobs. So the company could phone up and you get someone speaking highly of you. I think, yeah, it goes a long way. It really does, especially within the industry. We often say when I work with my colleagues, that it's a small industry when you're in there and everybody knows everybody. And mm-hmm. you will find that someone will know someone that knows someone who knows your guy that's on your CV or your girl or however it is. But I think, as long as you have that attitude to work long hours and not worry about it, it's definitely achievable without a doubt.
I love it. Nick, I really appreciate you coming on the show. You have my seal of approval to be press approved for Alpine, whatever that means. You do a very articulate speaker, great storytelling, people again, they really, really love to hear just what these roles look like and just kind of what the industry's like on the inside. I don't think anybody really cares about the IP stuff. I mean, other teams might, but I think people just want to get to know you. And you did a good job of communicating that. And I'm super excited for Alpine this year. I think you've got two bulldog drivers with something to prove. I think that's something I've always appreciated with Ocon. Is like he was once the golden boy and no longer the golden boy. And now he's proving he's the golden boy. And I like that. And then Gasly. Gasly's just a cool guy. I got to go hang out with him. Seriously, if you ever get stateside, always feel free to reach out. Anytime you ever want to come back on the show, you are always welcome. If you ever enter new roles, new teams, and you want to talk about it, you're always welcome here. Seriously, I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate everything you're doing as well.